This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Maternity pay varies depending on who you work for. It is a function of tax. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people and giving to another. This, in my view, is excessive.
I want the Conservative Party to be the trade union for the working people of this country.
I have been the face and voice of four different prime ministers, and I have been a team player.
It starts with making sure we get the right leadership, because as we all know, leaders matter, leaders count, and making sure we have the right leader changes the way our party will act.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Well, we like to come to you from the most glamorous of locations, particularly during party conference season. And Kieran and I are currently sitting at Tory Party Conference in Birmingham in what is basically a hallway between the press area and sort of the rest of the conference area, which actually sounds pretty good. It's good sort of studio acoustics, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a perfect soundproof booth, and it is about double the size of our normal broom cupboard. So this is the lap of luxury for me.
But we'll come on to what we're up to at Tory Conference later on. First of all, though, just I think it was worth recapping what's happened over the weekend. The big global news story is, of course, that there's been further Israeli strikes on Lebanon today and over the weekend. And they're causing widespread alarm over the situation in the Middle East. This, of course, comes after the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, was killed by Israeli airstrikes. And Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, was at the United Nations in New York at the end of last week and was part of a group of countries that called, the UK was part of a group of countries that called for an immediate 21-day ceasefire, but which was rejected by Israel. And obviously the Foreign Office is really worried about what happens next, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there was a couple of things interesting, I think, about Britain's role in all of that. You're right that they were part of this group, but they were by no means one of the leading members of that group. And in fact, that push was led by the US and France. France, of course, having good connections to Iran and with the Iranian leadership, which is why they were involved in that. But it was interesting because Keir Starmer had given a speech, as you say, at the UN, in which he talked about British foreign policy being less paternalistic, which I thought was really interesting. And he talked about Britain, you know, talking less and listening more. The problem is, when these big world events come, British people generally expect Britain to be at the forefront, making things happen. And I think that's the essential challenge he's going to face, that Britain isn't that power, not anymore. It isn't obviously the Atlantic bridge between America and the EU in the way that it used to be able to play that role. It does have some strategic alliances around the world where it can play, you know, a very important role, but it is not probably an absolute tier one global power. And I think part of his message is going to have to be to the British people, well, sorry, that's just the role we play now in world affairs.
Interesting. And of course, there's a more immediate problem from a British perspective of getting about 5,000 British citizens who are currently in Lebanon out, given that most flights have been grounded. I think that they had been asked to register with the Foreign Office. I don't know whether all of them managed to do that, but I keep hearing on the radio and reading online stories of people that are there and are struggling to get away and are really quite scared about it all. So that's something that we'll be keeping a very close eye on at The Guardian in coming days. But it's not the only thing that is occupying the Labour Party, of course. They have had yet another round of stories over the weekend on freebies and donations. Doesn't seem to go away despite their best efforts to close it down, for example, by saying that they're going to change the rules on donations, as Pat McFadden did yesterday. And then right into the middle of it all, quite an explosive story, one of their own Labour backbenchers, Rosie Duffield, quitting the party. Now, I've been speaking to some Labour people over the last 24 hours about that. I'm sure you have too. What have they been saying, Kieran?
Well, I was talking to a minister the evening after Rosie Duffield quit, as you say, quite spectacularly. And this minister said to me, this is somebody who worked for about 6 weeks to make sure Labour didn't get elected, and then got returned as a Labour MP and then quit. So this minister was saying, look, she basically has caused trouble for us all the way through the election campaign. She was very critical of Keir Starmer, very publicly, time and time again. And it's actually one of those stories that, while it obviously generated a lot of negative headlines for Labour for about 48 hours, I think there is a sense in the party that it's almost something that's united them after quite a fractious few weeks. And some people think this might actually help.
Well, because they feel that they're better off without her. And she probably feels, she almost certainly feels, that she's better off without them. And of course, this isn't a new thing, despite some of the stuff in her letter about it being, her being concerned about, you know, the winter fuel payment. She abstained, obviously, in that vote. It goes back a long way. I mean, I remember speaking to politicians and, in fact, probably writing stories at various points over the last few years about how Rosie Duffield was really unhappy with the direction of the party, felt that she wasn't being taken seriously enough or listened to. And it kind of feels like it's been on the cards. And I suspect that there'll be quite a lot of anger probably in her constituency in Canterbury that she ran on a Labour platform, despite the fact, as you say, she might not have been the most helpful to them, that she ran on a Labour platform. She was elected because she was Labour MP. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. If she ran as an independent, I don't suppose we'd have had this result. And then now, after she was elected, returned as a Labour MP for the constituency, just a few months later, she stands down, but will still be representing them and, you know, taking the taxpayers' money to do that.
Well, look, and the background to this, for those that don't know, is, of course, one of the big issues that she's been concerned with over the last few years is trans rights, and she is on the gender critical end of that debate, and she feels that the Labour Party has moved around and you know, gone too far into identity politics that she doesn't agree with, and she brings this up a lot. And even as I think Keir Starmer was probably moving towards her position over the last year or so, she hasn't been very happy with it. So look, she is particularly animated by one issue. She feels the party doesn't represent her views on that issue. Fair enough, to a certain extent. Okay, maybe you need to look for a political home elsewhere. I just think it's the timing of it. As you say, this has been an issue for a long time. She stood on a Labour platform, then she quits just as Labour are slightly struggling. There's a lot of irritation in the Labour ranks, and I think they'll almost feel bonded by this resignation rather than split apart.
Well, talk about parties and whether they're united or not. We are, of course, here in Birmingham at the Conservative Party Conference, which for the third time in their history has become what we've called a beauty parade of candidates. There's four of them, Kimmy Badenoch, James Cleverly, Robert Jenrick and Tom Tugendhat, vying to become leader. And they're going to be spending the next 3 days attempting to woo their party members, donors and MPs before they're narrowed down to the last two. Now, we've been doing the rounds of conference, of the fringes, of the bars, meeting politicians. How have you picked up the mood, Kieran?
Well, the first thing to say is this is a very different Tory party conference to last year, or probably the last few years. It is much quieter, probably unsurprisingly. There are no queues to get in.
Yeah, I got straight in this morning.
That was very
just
nice.
As well, given it was raining.
Yeah. Yesterday I turned up, I got straight in. There was absolutely no one here. I got to my desk in the press area and I thought, God, this conference is really dead. And then I looked at the schedule and realised it hadn't started yet. So I kind of
very
did have
keen
to.
Keen of you being
I was,
here. I think you're trying
here
to get brownie points.
But no, it is much quieter. But I like that about it. These are the party faithful. These are the people who really matter. There are fewer lobbyists, fewer hangers on, dare I say it, fewer journalists here in attendance. This is a party talking to itself, and that's kind of what conference is supposed to be about. So I think there is a decent energy. I would say there's a lot of energy right now in the Robert Jenrick campaign, which has spent the first 24 hours absolutely, dare I say it, celebrating, because the first news cycle of this conference has been about Kemi Badenoch and her comments about maternity pay, and they just think this plays for them spectacularly well. So in fringe events, even last night over drinks, I was talking to quite a few members of his team who couldn't believe their luck.
Well, we'll come on to exactly what she said in a minute, grabbing the headlines in the way that so many of her fellow MPs fear that she might do were she to win the contest. But yesterday was also a bit weird because we had the Conservative Party leader, who is, of course, Rishi Sunak.
Oh, yeah.
You may have forgotten this.
Yeah.
He pitched up for one day only and did a members-only event, which some press managed to crowd into.
I couldn't get in.
It was that popular.
It was that popular.
Well,
I could not get into the Rishi Sunak event.
Fortunately, they sent us around some of his words. And he basically, he didn't so much as apologise to party members, but he shared his regret that the election had turned out the way that it had and urged them to be united and to focus on picking the best candidate going forward. He obviously didn't say who his preference would be. But this conference really is about the future direction of the Conservative Party. It's not about individual policies, although we're hearing a lot about migration, we're hearing a lot about the economy. It's about really the bigger picture, whether it responds to the reform threat and pitches to the right, whether it tries to kind of like take a sort of a broader overview and hold together that voter coalition that previous prime ministers managed to do by also keeping the Lib Dem, you know, the left wing on of the Tory party, lots of people who they lost this time round, on board. And that's really sort of at the heart of all of this. And as I say, we're going to have lots of opportunities to hear from everyone. I think later today we have Q&As with Tom Tugendhat and Bait Dannoch on the main stage. And then we have, for the first and only time, I think, all four candidates on the stage together at a Centre for Social Justice event with Ian Duncan-Smith later tonight. And then we have Robert Jenrick and James Cleverly on the main stage doing the sort of same event that that Bait Dannoch and Tugendhat are doing today, tomorrow, on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, the conference is wrapped up with 20-minute speeches from each of them, which will be their parting shot to members as they go back to their constituencies and, you know, make a decision on how they're going to vote when the contest gets beyond the MP stage. Obviously, they need to whittle it down to the final two and then goes out to the members.
Do you know what I'm quite enjoying about this contest and about these few days is that each of these candidates has a slightly different way to capture the attention. Having four people in this beauty parade is it's really difficult for one of them to break through. It's not just, you know, like David Davis and David Cameron back in 2005. It's not just having a runoff between two people, both of whom get their opportunity to make waves. You've got four people all vying for attention. And I was walking down the kind of tunnel between the fringe tents yesterday, and suddenly there was a great crowd in front of me and I couldn't get through. And I thought, what on earth's going on? And then I looked ahead of me and there's Tom Tugendhat on a literal soapbox that he's carried around with him. And he's just plonked it down quite cunningly in between two tents where lots of people are trying to get past. So he's ended up with a big crowd giving a little impromptu speech. Robert Jenrick, meanwhile, decided not to turn up at the Tory Business Morning this morning because he wanted to give another speech. So he's booked out a separate venue to give an extra speech. His people on his campaign say that he just thought 20 minutes wasn't quite enough. So each of them are doing these kind of things to desperately try and capture attention, which gives the whole conference this slightly freewheeling, wild sense. You know, anything can happen at any moment.
I was on the phone to Downing Street this morning, doing my normal sort of, you know, morning call, finding out what's going on with government, and there was this massive cheer in the background and sort of this round of applause erupted, and the person I was on the phone to, was who knew I was at Conservative conference, was like, oh my goodness, what's going on, what's happened? And it was I was out in a big open area and James Cleverly had turned up, right. And there was a whole crowd of his supporters waving banners. He was there with his wife, and it was kind of like a pop-up, it was kind of like a flash mob sort of James Cleverly celebration. So we mentioned we were going to come on to Kemi Badenoch and why she ended up in the news yesterday, not for reasons that she would have liked, of course, because she started off the day going on Kunzberg, the BBC politics show, and spent most of the time being interviewed about her comments about culture, in which she had said in an article that some cultures are more valid than others. And she may have wanted to get onto other areas, you know, the economy, the NHS, migration and so on, but most of the questions were aimed at her take on community cohesion, which I think is one of the areas where, you know, she's got some pretty interesting things to say and some pretty controversial things to say. So you can understand why she was being pursued on it. But in her round of media interviews, she then went on, I think it was to Times Radio, where she was interviewed by Kate McCann and the presenter. And she told her that she thought maternity pay was excessive and more people should exercise more personal responsibilities. She said that one of the principles she was fighting her contest on was around a call for the state to do less, because the answer, in her words, can't be to let the government help people to have babies. Now, this, of course, sparked off a bit of a row, lots of Conservative women pointing out that actually things have changed an awful lot over the last four decades since maternity pay was introduced, not least that more women are in the workplace, that they can't afford to stay at home. The days of being, even if they wanted to, the days of being sort of looked after by their husband to stay at home and bring up babies were long gone. And actually we live in a world where women actually quite enjoy being able to go out and get, you know, get a job and proceed in their careers and rely on their partners to help bring up their children, but also have the state support them, help support them, so they can take a decent chunk of time off, up to a year now, with very small babies. So anyway, it's one of these subjects everyone has a view on, right? And certainly to Kemi Badenoch's cost, she discovered that yesterday, and her team were doing a sort of a desperate attempt to clarify her remarks. Not sure how you can clarify
them. They were saying it's about red tape, which
all you need to do is listen to the clip, and you see that that's not the case, but recognize that it was going to be, that it was potentially problematic. And lo and behold, there she is, written up in quite a critical sense on the front page of this morning's Telegraph and others.
Yeah, well, and this is what she said on X. Contrary to what some have said, I clearly said the burden of regulation on business had gone too far. Of course, I believe in maternity pay. And I should say that in that interview with Kate McCann, she did say the level of maternity pay is neither here nor there. So those were her words, and that was her clarification. I'll tell you two reasons why it was so damaging. The first is, and this is something I think you only pick up from coming to events like this, to Tory conference, a lot of people within Tory circles are very concerned about birth rates among non-immigrant communities. And it just keeps coming up at fringe events and, you know, in speeches on the platform, people keep talking about the birth rate. Now, if you're going to make an argument that people should be having more babies, taking maternity pay away from them probably isn't going to be a good way to do that. So even people on the right that you might think would be sympathetic with some of these comments actually aren't. And then, of course, you know, I think people more on the centre and the left are very annoyed by them as well. The other real problem is what it tells Tory members is that Kemi Badenoch is liable to blow up at any point. And that's what they're quite worried about. So one thing that you hear quite a lot around the corridors here is, I really like Kemi Badenoch, but if we elect her a leader, is she going to be there in 5 years' time to take on the Labour Party, or will she have picked a fight that ends up going catastrophically wrong and she has to step down? So I think that that sense of chaos, while it's done her quite well and could certainly get her attention as leader of the opposition, allies of other candidates are quite happy to let that impression get out there that this is the chaos agent.
But she's unpredictable, and it's also about the right sort of attention, isn't it? Is that if you're leader of the opposition and it's the wrong sort of attention, particularly for a public who already regard the Conservative Party as beset by infighting and chaos, do you really want more of that?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the discussion that's been had around here at conferences. Do they go for somebody who is probably a bit less likely to grab the headlines, but also a bit safer, actually, that they're not going to, there's not the element of risk involved. And somebody that could do what the party feels, that many in the party feel they need to do, which is proper introspection as to why they lost the general election campaign so badly, and start to rebuild from that, rather than from, as multiple politicians have told me, Tory politicians, you know, start a fight in an empty room, which is her reputation. Now, the flip of it, of course, is that she would take the fight to Labour. She's a good communicator and very articulate, and she is prepared to talk about things that many people aren't. But I think that there is such persistent questions about character that, you know, that's damaging her. And there is a real feeling that, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a highly organised campaign, but there's a Stop Kemi sentiment amongst quite a lot of the MPs who are thinking quite carefully about where they place their vote to whittle down the last four to the last two. Because the feeling is that if she makes it to the last two and it goes to the membership, then it's probably hers to lose.
Yeah. And then there's Robert Jenrick, who I think possibly surprisingly to a lot of people, at least would have been a surprise at the start of this campaign, is starting to emerge as the favourite. What's really interesting about him, and what I've started to hear from allies of his and also critics of his, is that he is running the Keir Starmer playbook in this leadership contest. So Robert Jenrick used to be seen as a centrist. He was an ally of Rishi Sunak and Oliver Dowden. The three of them famously wrote an article in support of Boris Johnson that helped get Boris Johnson over the line with his leadership bid. And they were seen as a kind of new, modernising, young generation in the parliamentary Conservative Party. He then went into government and became immigration minister, and then quit spectacularly over the Rwanda scheme and became really Rishi Sunak's chief critic on the immigration issue, is now positioning himself as the candidate of the right, certainly of the anti-immigration right. But what people around here tell me is that, oh, yeah, he's doing that now, But if you look at what he's done in the past, he's always able to tack left and right, and he'll inevitably tack left if he then does win the contest, similar to what Keir Starmer did. The problem with that is it looks quite inauthentic, especially if that's what your allies are going out there actively briefing.
And especially as, you know, for all you say about Kemi Badenoch, his main rival, she is authentic.
Right, right.
And it's, you know, it has been oft written and commented on that Robert Jenrick's been on a bit of a journey. I mean, I remember him as a sort of a fairly moderate, middle-of-the-road Tory minister who was nicknamed among his colleagues as Robert Generic, and now is sort of making this pitch to the right, has lost lots of weight, obviously had an image over, you know, image makeover. And, you know, he will argue that his position on immigration, he thought the Rwanda bill was a mistake, it didn't go far enough, it wasn't tough enough. He quit over it as immigration minister. He will argue that that has been, you know, has opened his eyes to thinking about all this in a different way. But the problem is for him is that there's quite a high degree of scepticism about what he really believes. And I think the very fact that, you know, as you say, people are expecting him to kind of pull back, gravitate back towards the centre a bit, will put off some of those members that actually want them to be taking on reform on their own territory. And of course, there's another couple of candidates, Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly, and it slightly feels like we're talking about them as an afterthought, but I don't think we can dismiss them. Although they do both occupy the same sort of ground when it comes to MP support, and that is their biggest problem, because they were almost level pegging. James Cleverly was slightly ahead in the last round of MPs voting, but he had stayed relatively static, and Tom Tugendhat caught up. And these are very small numbers, there's only 120 Tory MPs, but it felt like the momentum was maybe slightly more with him. And unless either of them pulls out, which there's absolutely no sign of them doing, then they're going to split that sort of more moderate vote and probably pave the way for Badenoch to make it into the final two. They both are regarded as being fairly mainstream as Conservative Party politicians go. James Cleverly in particular is known as a unifier. He's very affable. He, as Foreign Secretary, got on very well with diplomats, as party chair, sort of managed the party well. He is a good communicator. And he's seen as somebody who, while maybe doesn't necessarily have as many pros attached to them as the other candidates, has far fewer cons. And because of that, is somebody who is perhaps more palatable to everybody right across the board, which is kind of maybe not the most exciting or glamorous platform to be running on. But in this very, very turbulent time for the Conservative Party, that sort of safe haven, that sort of stability, that sort of, you know, common sense, knowing what he stands for, predictable approach, also a good performer at the dispatch box, would take the fight to Labour. You can see why people might find that attractive.
Yeah, well, I give you some of the pros. I mean, he looks the part and he sounds the part. He just comes across as someone who's comfortable in his own skin. And that actually is quite a rare commodity in politics. And I think that really helps him. Now, I was at a drinks party last night in quite a cosy room in the Hyatt Hotel where Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly both turned up and were involved in a very cosy conversation for a while. I would say there were lots of hacks nearby, so I don't think they were actually plotting anything. But these two obviously get on. They occupy the same part of the party, and they would make natural bedfellows in each other's shadow cabinets. Tom Tugendhat, meanwhile, is trying his best to be the insurgent, I think, in this contest. I mentioned the soapbox earlier. He wants to be the person who kind of comes through unexpectedly, a bit like David Cameron in 2005. It's possible. I think he's quite popular, but I think out of those two centrist candidates, James Cleverly is probably just ahead of Tugendhat at the moment.
We'll have to see how they do on the stage. I mean, that could be the crucial moment, in the same way that David Cameron wowed the Tory membership when he was up on stage, compared with a fairly sort of heavy-footed speech that was delivered by David Davis, who at that point obviously had been the one that everybody had their eye on. But, you know, it's hard to overstate how bruising the last election was for the Conservative Party. I mean, it was a historic election defeat. And there is this sense that you touched on earlier, Kieran, that this might just be a filler leader, that this is somebody who, you know, will get the party back on a slightly more stable footing, but actually won't last the whole 5 years to the next election. And actually somebody else will appear at that point to take the fight to Labour properly when it comes to winning the country. And the backdrop to this conference is a new book or a book out by one Boris Johnson, the former Prime Minister, who, of course, often gets talked about as a potential returnee. And there's always sort of rumours that from his allies that, you know, he's eyeing up a seat, or that he thinks he hasn't had his time. His time in politics isn't over. And, you know, he wants to return to the world stage in that way. Now, I have my doubts, not least because he's currently earning about 10 million quid a year.
10 million pounds a year.
And that's... is able to pick and choose which causes he gets behind and gets involved in. And of course, he's talked a lot about Ukraine and supporting Zelensky in the fight against Russia. So he will have to, I think there's an interview with him with the BBC this Thursday, which we'll all be watching. But if the excerpts from his book were anything to go by, it seems to be kind of like reheating a lot of what we already know, just with his slightly creative perspective, should we say.
Can I just say one thing, which is I was at a fringe event organised by the think tank Onward yesterday, which was presenting some findings about why the Tories lost so badly at this election. They interviewed people who'd voted Tory in 2015, 2017 and 2019 to find out what were the top things they thought went wrong. Number one was illegal migration. Number two was legal migration. And number three was getting rid of Boris Johnson.
They'd have him back in a heartbeat. Well, let's see what happens in the next couple of years, whether we're going to be sitting in this same hallway, Kieran, discussing the astonishing shock return of Boris Johnson or not. But we'll have to wait and see. Anyway, that's all from us. We'll be back on Wednesday with John Harris straight after the final beauty parade speech and with more from behind the scenes of conference. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to get our podcasts. And if you'd like to leave us a review, we'd love to hear from you. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. Chock full of chat and brimming with autumn cheer. Join me as I talk to the likes of Stanley Tucci, Vanessa Feltz, Richard E. Grant and Rag & Bone Man about life, love and the grub that has seen them through. New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.